is something that is going to destroy the standards that the Quran has established for the society, and it is very dangerous.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, as I mentioned in the previous segment, that the type of book, the type of recitation of the Quran which will be liked by the people is the one that is interpolated and changed. Of course, that doesn't mean that the apparent words of the Quran will be changed. No. It is the meanings that will be changed. It will be the soul and the reality of the Quran that people will change and manipulate while maintaining the apparent letters and words in the same manner. The example is the scholar of Sulaiman bin Abdul Malik. Sulaiman bin Abdul Malik was one of those leaders at the time of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, and he was a very evil person, a wretched person who had first of all a very hard heart, and also his character was weak amongst the Umayyad caliphs. He had a scholar, or you can say a speech giver or an orator that was working under his authority. And that orator would speak about the Quran, would interpret the Quran and about the oneness of God, about the prophethood, in such a way that would confirm with the character and the belief system and the makeup of this caliph or this leader called Sulaiman bin Abdul Malik. That means if Sulaiman bin Abdul Malik were to hear that Quran, would feel that he is in the right track. And if people would listen to that interpretation of the Quran, would feel that what Sulaiman ibn Abdul Malik is doing is actually what the Prophet wanted us to do, what the Quran is actually advocating. So this type of interpretation is a destructive interpretation, but it is a type of interpretation which was on demand, which was given value, where people were ready to spend money. And today even we'll see the same, that people are ready to spend money for this type of false interpretation of the Holy Quran that conforms with the materialistic demands of the people, especially those wealthy and oppressive ones. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the right understanding of the Holy Quran and to avoid the wrong interpretations so that we can actually and truly benefit from it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the bad side effects of corruption on the social arena, in society, or on a global level. Corruption contributes to the spread of despair among citizens and the spread of frustration that negatively affects work and creativity of the citizen and people. The only way that any society or any country can flourish is when the people, the members of such a system, the citizens of such a system, when they have full capacity to work and be creative. And creativity itself, it comes when a person has the means of comfort. Let's not say like 100%, but at least he's not deprived of the essentials. He have, you know, care system is there, health system is there, education system is there, there's a pay system happening in case someone cannot find employment, and so on and so forth. When some of these are met, as human beings, we will flourish, and we will produce, and we will be creative, we will create, we will invent. Thus, society develops. We make the lives of others a lot easier. But when corruption is there and people are not getting their rights, their mental state deteriorates, and then they have nothing. So instead of me being imaginative and being creative and being, I don't know, a scientist and trying to invent and create, I'm going to be in a sense of despair, in a sense of inner frustration, in a sense of just trying to worry about my day, worry about my family. The last thing that will come to my mind is how to save humanity, for example, or how to cure a disease, or how to invent something that might serve others. I wouldn't be thinking about that, because I need to live. I need to find my way in this messed up world. So it does create a problem. So people don't have work, for example, it will affect their creativity, their imagination, their ability to invent. And also it affects the work itself, even those who work, because they work under extreme circumstances and they're not getting enough of what they should be getting, then obviously the amount of work, or the quality of work, I should say, that they put in is not going to be the same. When, for example, you live in a system where the system is not giving its workers enough wages, the wages are not enough to support them monthly or weekly or fortnightly, those people who work under that system, their work will be less. The quality of it will be a lot less, which will affect, obviously, the rest of the people, would affect me and you. For example, if we go to a department, I'm trying to get a driver's license, and those people who work in this department, they're not getting enough money. Do you think they're going to be happy serving me, or are they going to be excited trying to give me a service? Some people might do that, some of the workers, out of their own will, out of their own genuine, pure heart. But a lot of them say, you know what, I don't give a damn about what is happening to people. I'm just going to sit at the table, do as much as I can, but without putting that effort. So it does affect their work as well. Not only it affects their work, but it affects also their creativity whether we're talking on a social level or on a, you know, just an individual level. Because people would have that mental problem to deal with, yet alone trying to create. Let us take a break, then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to IRIB English Radio and to the program for humanity. Corruption usually allows people who live in a state to migrate from their countries, from their comfort place, to seek comfort somewhere else. And sometimes we lose people who are qualified. So, for example, you could live in a country where you have a lot of scientists, you have a lot of doctors, you have a lot of visionary people. But those people, they live in a state or in a country where it does not give them the bare minimum to live. What do you think that will happen? Or what do you think will happen in this case? Obviously, those people will try to migrate to a different state, to a different place, where they could provide for themselves and for their family and create a better living and standard of living for themselves. So if I was a doctor and I live in a country where the economy is so bad and so corrupt, and, for example, the currency is so low compared to a lot of places, I say, well, you know what? I'm better off in a different country. Let me migrate. Let me move somewhere else where a doctor gets paid high and their living standards are a lot higher. So they migrate. And this migration, then we have a problem that the society that they left becomes crumbled. It doesn't have enough doctors, or at least doesn't have qualified doctors, good qualified doctors, or scientists, or what have you, whatever qualification that you can think of. They will leave their societies empty-handed, and then that society itself will only get worse and worse and worse, to the state where maybe even the citizens themselves decide to leave because they say, well, you know, if I need anything good, I'm not going to find it here. I'm going to find it somewhere else. If I want a good surgeon, surely he's not going to be here, so I have to travel to another country because all the surgeons in my country, for example, they went to this country. And we can see that happening. For example, if you look at the civilized countries, you see the top surgeons and top doctors and top scientists are actually people who belong to another country. They are foreigners to the countries they are in, even though they might have a citizenship, a green card, or what have you. But at the end of the day, they are, you know, They came from the Middle East, for example, or from India, or from China, Asia, Russia. They just had to migrate because these countries, it was not providing them what they need because there was a sense of corruption, because there were people who are in power who did not care of what happens to people, migrate or don't migrate. They say, well, as long as I'm happy, as long as my wealth is accumulated, as long as my bank account is fat, who cares about people? They can worry about their own. They don't like it, they could move somewhere else. This is the mentality that a lot of systems have. And that's why people get so frustrated and get so anxious and worried, and you know, they fall into this state, and sometimes they uprise, sometimes they revolt, sometimes they create havoc in that system, and a lot of lives get lost in the process, and so on and so forth. Only because some people decide to deprive the rest of the people their necessities and create that sense of corruption in such a society. So it's not something that we should take lightly and look at as a minor thing. We'll leave it up to here. We continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
In the limelight.
Corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources, while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States, says Julie Hollar, writer, in an article titled Missing Voices in Broadcast Coverage of Afghan Withdrawal. Stay tuned for more. As the U.S., after 20 years, finally began its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the story dominated TV news. Just as they did when the war began, corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States. FAIR studied a week of Afghanistan coverage, starting with the day the Taliban took back Kabul. FAIR looked at the three prime-time broadcast news shows, ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and NBC Nightly News, identifying 74 sources across the three shows. Of these sources, 23 sources were Afghans, 20 were identified as Afghan-Americans, and 31% of all sources. Only 11 of these 23, fewer than half, were identified by at least a first name, and only 4 were women. Afghans often have only one name. While 3 Afghan sources were identified as professionals who might have offered informed commentary on the broader political or historical situation, a journalist, a member of parliament, and a nonprofit director, the vast majority of questions to all Afghan and Afghan-American sources were about their personal risk and situation, essentially providing color rather than expert opinion to the story. Americans who were not Afghans comprised the remaining 51 sources, with no other nationalities represented. Of these U.S. sources, 31 were non-Pentagon government officials, and 16 were current or former military, from the Secretary of Defense to enlisted troops. The remainder were 3 parents of Americans killed in the war, and the non-Afghan U.S. citizens evacuating from Afghanistan. The partisan breakdown of U.S. officials was 29 Democrats to 8 Republicans. with President Joe Biden accounting for 14 of the Democratic sources and other members of his administration accounting for 12. No scholars or anti-war activists from either the U.S. or Afghanistan were featured. Only two civil society leaders made appearances, the director of a nonprofit women's organization in Afghanistan and the president of a New York City veterans organization. Despite the media's emphasis on the plight of women in Afghanistan as a result of U.S. withdrawal, women were rarely considered experts or even voices worth hearing on this story. Only 8 sources were female, 11% of the total, 2 of whom were unnamed. And corporate journalists themselves, who have often been the loudest cheerleaders for Afghanistan war, continued their jingoism in the face of the withdrawal. NBC's chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel, for instance, offered an echo of rather than a counterpoint to McConnell and Abdul. A 20-year war, the longest in U.S. history, today ended a disgrace. The U.S. leaving behind a country its citizens are too terrified to live in. Similarly, CBS Nora O'Donnell declared, "When America leaves, for many, so does the hope of freedom, the hope for human rights, and in place comes the sheer terror of what's next." O'Donnell went on to detail the number of Americans killed and wounded, plus the unspecified cost to America's national security. Given that the withdrawal was an acknowledgement that after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. had little control over what kind of country it would be leaving behind, it's hardly to imagine a withdrawal that Engel would not have considered a disgrace. But while he and O'Donnell highlighted the plight of many Afghans, neither made any mention of the number of Afghans killed or wounded in the 20-year war, which was at least 27 times higher than U.S. casualties, according to the Cost of War Project at Brown University. That project estimated that at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed, including more than 500 humanitarian workers and journalists, along with over 69,000 national military and police and more than 52,000 opposition fighters. But these tallies, which do not even include the wounded or excess, I mean, indirect death, are almost certainly undercounts. New Yorker reporter Anand Gopal, who has spent years covering the war, including time in rural Afghanistan, believes that the available death tolls have grossly undercounted civilian casualties, as much of the ongoing conflict has taken place in outlying areas where deaths frequently go unrecorded. Gopal's recent article, New Yorker, on rural Afghan women recounted his investigation in the largely rural Helmand province, where he interviewed a random selection of 12 households, finding that each had lost, on average, 10 to 12 civilians to the war. While the Taliban rule was not popular among those he interviewed, it was clearly preferred to U.S. occupation, which had empowered even more ruthless warlords and ensured unending conflict, airstrikes, and terror in the region. This perspective was not to be found on U.S. TV news coverage of the withdrawal, with its correspondents reporting from the airbase in Kabul and Afghanistan, a world apart from that known by the majority of the country's population. NBC's Lester Holt, who visited Afghanistan in 2010 and 2012, offered a typical assessment, painting the occupation as a sensitive operation bringing Afghanistan out of darkness into a brighter future, saying, "Traveling across Afghanistan a decade into the war in 2012, it was hard not to feel some optimism, as if we were witness to a country emerging from darkness. Through the war, epic American-led battles reclaimed cities and villages from the Taliban. U.S. commanders nurtured trust among village elders, believing in Afghanistan's future. And now, in the chaos, we are left to wonder how that future has been so rapidly rewritten with the chapters from Afghanistan's past. 2 weeks later, on the eve of the official withdrawal, CBS O'Donnell asked longtime Pentagon correspondent David Martin, "What does this moment mean?" Martin responded, "To me, it's on all of us as American citizens. We as a country could not summon the will to outlast the Taliban. We sent more than 800,000 troops to fight in the war. The vast majority of them did everything we asked of them. They would have gone back for another 20 years if we had asked them. But the country grew tired of the war, and they elected political leaders, both Democratic and Republican, who wanted to end it. History will decide whether that was right or wrong. But either way, Nora, it's on us." Unquote. Perspectives of U.S. troops were occasionally presented, but segments featuring veterans' voices seemed largely intended to reassure viewers that the 20-year war was worth it. Some veterans are thinking, was it worth it? Were U.S. sacrifices worth it? O'Donnell said, followed immediately by a soundbite from a veteran. "It was worth it. We gave Afghanistan 2 decades of freedom. It made the world a better place," unquote. Notably, post-9/11 veterans had soured on the war over the past decade. While a 2011 Pew poll found that 50% believed the Afghanistan war had been worth fighting, the outfit's 2019 poll found that the number had dropped to 38%, roughly on par with the general public. Afghanistan veterans were more likely than the general public to support the withdrawal. 58% versus 52%, even after it was well underway and the subject of widespread one-sidedly hostile media coverage in Morning Consult.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, He was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال علي عليه السلام من الخرق المعاجلة قبل الإمكان والأناة بعد الفرصة.
Imam Ali said, to make haste before the proper time, or to delay after a proper opportunity, in either case, is folly. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, in this truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, it is interesting, but despite all of the different sessions that we have had up to this point discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, we find that there is still so much we can talk about when it comes to Imam Ali's persona being truly universal. And so it is unanimously agreed, both among the Shia scholars and the Sunni scholars, and even the non-Muslim scholars, that Imam Ali was the most pious man of his time. And he was so pious in his time that he had divorced the world 3 times, meaning he had completely renounced the world. Now, for some of our listeners who might not understand this statement or this remark of divorcing the world 3 times, just to explain this a little bit. So in the jurisprudence, in the fiqh or the ahkam, the Islamic rules and regulations, the laws and commandments of Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, we find that in the religion of Islam, you are allowed to have a divorce for a maximum of 3 times. So very interesting. I know it's a little bit of a tangent, but it seems to be important. In other religions, we will find that you only have the option cut from a little bit of a tangent. So in Islam, you can be married and then have a divorce, then be married, then have a divorce, then be married, and then have a divorce the 3rd time. Now, this 3rd time that you have a divorce, you cannot go and marry the same individual again. And so here, Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, he has this famous statement where he says that he has divorced the world 3 times, meaning his piety and his God consciousness, his awareness of God, his awareness of Allah, was to an extent where he had divorced the world 3 times over, meaning a divorce, a separation, a going of different ways where one cannot return. Imam Ali taught humanity that truly, if you want
to move towards Allah, if you want to communicate with Allah, if you want to have a strong relationship with God, then you must disassociate yourself from the world. You cannot love the world. As the famous saying goes, and the Holy Quran says, that man has not been created with two hearts in his chest. Breaking away from the world, if we want to become pious, a profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, you must not allow uncertainties and doubt poison your mind. Skepticism or irrational likes and dislikes should not affect your views. But remember that before you start thinking and deliberating over a problem, seek guidance of the Lord and beseech Him to give you a lead in the right direction. Avoid confusion in your ideas, and do not let disbelief take hold of your mind, because the first will lead you to agnosticism and the others towards errors and sins. When you are thus prepared to solve any problem, and you are sure that you possess a clear mind, a sincere and firm desire to reach the truth, to say the correct thing, and to do the correct deed, then carefully go through the advice that I am leaving for you. If your mind is not clear, and it is not as free from doubts as you wish it to be, then you'll be wandering in the wilderness of uncertainties and errors, like a camel suffering from night blindness. Under these circumstances, it is best for you to give up the quest, because with such limitations, none can ever reach the truth.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
And I would like to begin with this first question about Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the question about who is Ali is actually a very simple question. What I want to answer tonight is the question of what is Ali? There is a difference between who is Ali and what is Ali. There is another hadith narrated by 24 companions of the Prophet. And this is narrated by Shia and Sunni sources alike, where the Prophet says, Aliyun ma'al haqq wal haqq ma'a Aliyin. Ali is with the truth, and the truth is with Ali. Now, when we talk about this hadith, sometimes we get the question where the Prophet said the same thing about Ammar bin Yasir. Ammar is with Haqq, and Haqq is with Ammar. Remember, Ammar is a disciple of Ali. He is a student of Ali, who gave his life for the love of Ali in the Battle of Siffin. There is a difference in what the Prophet said about Ammar. In case of Ammar, he just said, you know, Ammar is ma'al haqq, wal haqq ma' Ammar. Ammar is with haqq, and haqq is with, the truth is with Ammar. When it comes to Ali bin Abi Talib, Rasulullah did something else there. After saying, Aliyun ma'al haqq, wal haqq ma' Aliyin, the Prophet prays to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allahumma adril haqq ma' Aliyin haysu ma dar. Not only that Ali is with Haqq and Haqq is with Ali, the Prophet prays to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that, O Allah, turn Haqq in whatever direction that Ali is turning. It's not that you have Haqq there as a standard and then may you measure Ali. Is he on Haqq or Batil? No. That is when you will measure Ammar, Salman, Miqdad, and others. When it comes to Ali, the issue is not, you know, measuring him with the haqq. Rather, Rasulullah says, praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that Allah turn haqq in whatever direction that Ali turns. And this is where we see that in spite of all these things. You know, we are really surprised.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who emerged as a leading critic of the New Conservatives. New Conservatives are characterized by their support of hawkish foreign policies. In remarks to Mass Peace Action last June, he made some brazen assertions about Israel.
I said the other day Israel would not be a state in 20 years. It'd be gone. It certainly will not be a democracy. It'll be an apartheid state, and the world will just reject it, as they did South Africa. But I'm now saying it probably won't be a state. It'll be gone.
He pointed to the 1946 Joint Chiefs of Staff to a State War Navy Coordinating Committee, noting that then U.S. President Harry Truman was trying at the time to decide whether to recognize Israel in 1947-48 and what to do about U.S. policy. Wilkerson said, Israel is a strategic liability of the first order for the United States, and the chances are very high it would drag Washington's feet into a full-fledged face-off.
Israel is the most likely state in the world to take the United States to Armageddon. And I could paint you all sorts of ways we would do that and the ways we would get there.
The retired general also revealed that during 40 years of military service, he had heard constant advice from everyone not to establish an American military base in the Israeli-occupied territories. He stressed that the United States standing with Israel against half of the world is not a good thing. The Israeli regime, he said, needs to be reined, but that would not happen.
Israel, I think, needs to be reined in, and it needs to be told in no uncertain terms, you will change, and you will change swiftly and effectively, or you can count your sugar daddy gone. Yeah, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
In fact, Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel for decades through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes.
Well, I certainly think that that's a possibility. I do agree that it is delegitimizing itself, even in the eyes of many Jews around the world, especially young Jews, which is going to make it hard, of course, for Israel to reproduce itself. And yes, I think it's being considered more and more a worldwide pariah.
Wilkerson has said that the obsession of U.S. neoconservatives, particularly former Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, is to plunge the entire Middle East region into chaos and to keep Israel's enemies at each other's throats so that they could not unite and give Israel trouble, militarily or otherwise. Wilkerson also pointed out that it does not matter for neoconservatives to target Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, or Iran in their pursuit to set the region on fire, as the important thing for them is to protect Israel. However, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The latest sign of this assertion is the U.S. House of Representatives' decision to pass a bill to provide $1 billion of additional funding to replenish Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system, despite the regime's blatant violation of Palestinian human rights.
In recent decades, the United States has increasingly used sanctions as an instrument of foreign policy. There are different types of sanctions, economic or financial restrictions, trade prohibitions, and blocking or seizing assets of individuals, organizations, and countries. Now, a coalition of North American human rights organizations, named the Sanctions Kill Coalition, has released a report on the impacts of the U.S. sanctions on other countries and their people. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The report has also revealed a bitter reality that Western media rarely or never talk about. One finding is that U.S. sanctions are hurting the most vulnerable and driving middle-class citizens into poverty. Also, they have resulted in thousands of deaths and humanitarian exemptions. For instance, U.S. sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank have collapsed the country's currency, sending millions of civilians into grinding poverty. Also, waiving sanctions by the U.S. undermine countries' capacity to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, resulting in loss of lives. The inhumane sanctions cause difficulty for countries like Iran, to obtain medical supplies, sanitation equipment, and other necessary goods to slow the virus spread. Therefore, the U.S. contributed to many unnecessary deaths in Iran.
So we've actually known for 100 years, at least a century, what the impact is. The impact is primarily felt by the civilian population, and it is devastating.
The report also says many U.S. sanctions are based on false claims of an emergency and a threat to national security. The 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York. World leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern, including rejecting inhumane sanctions. During his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country.
We ratify our request. Our demand to the United States and the European Union governments lift all the criminal sanctions against the Venezuelan economy, against the Venezuelan society. We say it with the reason and morality that we have, and we say it on behalf of 30 million Venezuelans.
Maduro denounced what he called permanent systematic aggression waged against Venezuela through these restrictions and called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. Also, Cuban President Díaz-Canel lashed out at the U.S. administration of Joe Biden for intensifying, quote, the cruelest economic blockade ever imposed against any nation.
The U.S. government has not for 1 minute ceased its attacks on Cuba. But at this crucial and challenging moment for all nations, its aggressiveness exceeds all limits. The cruelest and most prolonged economic, commercial, and financial blockade ever applied against any nation has been opportunistically and criminally intensified in the midst of the pandemic.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, the Cuban president said, "The U.S. is extorting sovereign states to act against countries it identifies as adversaries." He said the U.S. presses its allies to build coalitions to overthrow legitimate governments. Western media has failed, or maybe wanted to fail, to inform the public about the consequences and global condemnation of U.S. sanctions. Most U.S. citizens are unaware of the severe harm being done to millions of residents of countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Iran.
It's a primary foreign policy tool that the U.S. government uses in order to weaken and decimate countries that it has disputes with. It should be considered a crime against humanity. The kind of sanctions against a country, against a whole people or a whole nation, should be considered a crime against humanity because the effects are horrible.
Exacerbating the suffering of civilians in different countries during a severe health crisis such as the coronavirus pandemic is morally corrupt and a clear disregard for basic human rights. This is what U.S. sanctions have done. The U.S. may be quick to deny this, but deep down it wants sanctions to provoke the populations to rise against the government in the hopes of regime change in the respective countries, something it has for the most part failed to achieve.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe, I don't know, less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power, and furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid. Pro-Israel American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government's spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets to mark the 7th anniversary of the September 21 revolution against the Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a. Participants in the rally chanted slogans against foreign aggression while carrying the country's tricolor flag and pictures of top resistance leaders. They also denounced the criminal complicity of Western powers and the Israeli regime in the Saudi-backed aggression and war-ravaged Yemen. The demonstrators vowed to uphold their revolutionary ideals and not surrender to the foreign powers. They said the popular revolution had thwarted the conspiracy to divide Yemen through resistance to foreign aggression and hegemony.
Yemeni people are working hard to liberate themselves from the tutelage and occupation. It is known to the world that the occupation does not last, and no matter how long it remains, it will eventually depart.
In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed, unpopular regime of Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement on September 21 took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The massively popular protests were against an incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh and directed by the U.S. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, the Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign